Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
He was now the enemy of the Taliban, and the Taliban were their enemies, and they weren't enemies before, and now it just meant that their lives were in danger, and everybody that they knew felt like their lives were in danger. And so the West's entire mission was completely pointless, because they'd left the country in a worse state when they'd first arrived, and to him it had all been for nothing, basically.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. When I worked at the provincial reconstruction team in Helmand Province, I was largely based at the forward operating base in Lashkargah, the main city of that province. There, amid the dust and noise of an active military campaign, there was a small, beautifully tended garden inside the base. I'm going to be honest and say that I was too preoccupied with my own job ever to ask myself who was responsible for its upkeep, even as I enjoyed that little slice of tranquility and beauty almost every day. Had I stopped to find out, I would have learnt that the gardener was Shaista Gul, a local Afghan citizen whose hard work created a beautiful garden in the most unlikely place. By taking on that job, Shaista and the thousands of Afghans, many of them interpreters, that served Britain during its involvement in the NATO mission, they became enemies of the Taliban, facing constant threats and worse, including murder in some cases. After the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August 2021, some lucky Afghans were able to escape on evacuation flights from Kabul. You'll all remember those scenes of the crowds at the airport. But most were left behind, and thousands made their way to Pakistan, including many that had been assured of resettlement in the UK. This month, the government of Pakistan has decided to expel all undocumented Afghans in the country. That's believed to be around 1.5 million people. Of these, around 2,000 have been accepted as eligible to come to Britain in recognition of their past service with our forces. But thanks to a cost-saving policy made by Rishi Sunak last year, these people were kept in Pakistan in preference to bringing them to the UK, where of course the migration system is under acute strain. So now, these people who risk their lives serving our country find themselves threatened with being returned to Afghanistan by the Pakistani government. The story of Britain's treatment of those Afghans that worked with us during our involvement in that country is the subject of Larissa Brown's book, The Gardener of Lashkargah. Larissa is a defence correspondent, currently with The Times and previously working for the Daily Mail. She joined me just as Pakistan was preparing to start its campaign of expulsions to talk about Shaista Ghul and the wider history of Britain's betrayal of its Afghan friends. I started by asking her to describe her book.
Yes, so the story focuses on a man named Shaista Ghul, and he was the gardener at the main operating base in Lashkargah when British troops were in Helmand province. And he was employed directly by the British military. And he worked in the garden. He sort of created the entire place. It ended up being this oasis of calm and tranquility for troops who were desperate, I suppose, to escape the realities of the war outside the military base. And his son, Jamal Barak, became an interpreter at the age of just 17. And so the story focuses on Shaista, Jamal and the rest of the family and what they go through over the years until they eventually finish working for the British in 2014 when the troops pull out. And it's just it's an extraordinary story because of the way that they suffer as a result of that service and the way that their family face constant threats. Some of the family members are killed. Some of them are tortured. And this is all because of their direct involvement with the British military.
As it happened, I spent nearly a year of my life based in that specific location in Lashkargah. And I remember the garden, and it had this sort of beautiful, it was a very kind of perfect little jewel. And apparently, it got better in the following years as well. So it undoubtedly, a small thing like that could have had a big impact on the sort of thousands of people who passed through there. Of course, we're talking now, it's more than 2 years since the Taliban seized Kabul. And in fact, people remember the date of the 15th of August when they took Kabul, but 2 days earlier, Lashkargah, where this base was, fell. What was happening to your family, that the subject of your book, around that time?
So that time, it was a really difficult chapter. Jamal Barak, the interpreter, had already come to Britain. He'd been allowed in under one of the government's first schemes for allowing people who had worked with the British troops into the UK if their lives were deemed at sufficient risk. And he was getting messages from his father, from Shaista, who was in his house with his wife and his children, his sons. And the messages were, of course, getting more and more panicked. People knew who he was in Lashkargah. They knew that he'd been the gardener at the British military base. He'd been seen, walking in and out of the base every single day. He was terrified that as the Taliban were getting closer to Lashkargah, that he would be found and he would be killed. And Jamal was desperately trying to get him out. The British government had refused to allow him to the UK because he hadn't been an interpreter. So he hadn't been in one of those frontline roles like Jamal. I was in contact with Jamal at the time, I was trying to message other people to try and, raise his case. And eventually, Ben Wallace, who was then the defence secretary, did get Shaista's case on his desk, and he was asked to look at it because it was one of those cases where he could be considered eligible under the current criteria, but he needed to show that he was actually at risk of being killed by the Taliban. And Ben Wallace decided to let him in. And so I was in touch with Jamal then again when they were told that wonderful news. But it was sort of bittersweet at that point because Shaista was also told that his oldest son, who was over the age of 18, Mahmood, couldn't come. And Mahmood had been shot by the Taliban. He had a wife, but he was, reliant on the help of the whole family. In the end, Shaista decided to leave that his son Mahmood and take the other children to Kabul to try and get on a flight.
So many aspects of that story may be surprising to listeners, but also perhaps familiar to people who've had any sort of involvement with trying to help Afghans. So, for example, the fact that even though this man worked in the military base and was well known to be, you know, the gardener for the Brits, were you surprised about kind of strange bureaucratic obstacles?
Yes, I mean, I'd been I'd started a campaign in 2015 with one of my colleagues at the Daily Mail, David Williams, to try and get Afghan interpreters out of Afghanistan. And so this campaign, I've been doing it for 7 years by then, or 6 years by then. And through that, we'd met and spoken to a lot of different people, so mainly interpreters, but also people in other roles, such as chefs and mechanics, who had told us all about the death threats that they were facing from the Taliban, from the intimidation, from family members being shot at, killed on the doorstep. And so we knew that there was a real risk to those people's lives. And this is because the Taliban thought, you know, these people were the eyes and the ears of the British troops and the Americans, and that they wanted them dead. They saw them as the enemy at that point. And so we you know, I was very alive to the threat that they were facing. And with Shaista himself, he had also received warning of him about his job at the military base. And then once he left that job, his family still felt threatened. Jamal had been shot at whilst on the battlefield, Jamal, but also after that, he was also targeted by suspected Taliban members in Lashkar Gah. Then again, Shaista's son Mahmood was shot and his oldest son was killed. Just because he was a gardener, it didn't mean that his life wasn't at risk in the same way that other people's were at risk. And so it was just really heartbreaking at that time to hear from all those people who weren't considered, well, who were being told by the British Ministry of Defence that their lives weren't in sufficient danger, when actually, in reality, they were.
I mean, it's this bizarre spectacle of a bureaucrat in London who's sitting in complete safety, you know, deciding that they knew whether or not someone in Afghanistan was, you know, at risk of death.
Yes, and this was my major frustration over the years, because we were dealing with lots of different civil servants and different ministers. And it was just, you know, some people didn't even really understand the policy or how to apply the policy. It was being, you know, they were letting in some people but not others. In some cases, they were claiming that interpreters had sort of done something wrong, you know, they've been sacked for various reasons, but then the cases were getting mixed up. One bizarre case that I write about in the book, because the book is much, you know, it's also about lots of other Afghans as well as just Shaista's family, but one of the cases I write about is a man named Hanif, who was an interpreter, and he was told he wasn't eligible at the very last minute after being given the flight details and after buying his little girl's new dresses to take with him to England. He was told that he was no longer eligible because the Home Office had flagged up some concerns. Now, those concerns seemed to be like terrorist related or something security related. And then it all turned out to be a load of rubbish. The Americans accepted him, and the British later admitted that they got him mixed up with somebody else.
And those types of cases, in the aftermath of the fall of Kabul, as you all know, and of course some of this comes up in your book, that a lot of people, just private citizens, including myself, who'd had some link to Afghanistan, became involved with trying to help people out. And those cases where an inexplicable security concern, in inverted commas, that could be devastating, because almost by definition, you have no means of questioning, you know, that information. Of course, it's not impossible that there may be genuine intelligence about someone having a link to Taliban or whatever. But how on earth, you know, would one sort of unpick those kinds of stories? And it certainly seems to be that, you know, there have been several cases where people face those allegations.
Yeah, there's no appeal process, so it's not like you can submit a whole dossier of evidence disproving what the MOD claims. And actually, in a lot of those cases, as a journalist, I was being told the background. So, for example, in that case about the security concerns, but the MOD wouldn't pass that on to the actual individual. So it wasn't, you know, to Hanif, for example, he was just told, you know, sorry, you can no longer board this flight. Whereas I was then getting further guidance, and actually that was also very difficult for the individuals, because they didn't even know officially what they were actually being turned down for. And as I said, you know, the MOD did end up overturning many cases in the end, either because they were too harsh or because they just got the wrong file, and it was just as simple but as terrible as that.
One of the things that seems to have played into this this really quite sort of depressing story of betrayal is, as you said, you know, the bureaucrats not really understanding the rules themselves.
Yes. So in the early days, so when British troops pulled out in 2014, there were two policies in place, and one of them was the one that Jamal came under, which basically said if you were an interpreter that had served more than a year on the front line in Helmand province, then you'd be eligible to come to Britain. But there was a really strange detail in that you had to have served on an arbitrary date in 2012 in order to be allowed in. And so that excluded hundreds, if not thousands, of people for no reason at all. And you could also come in under a second scheme if you could prove you'd been intimidated. But actually, the MOD over years and years refused to let anyone into the UK under that policy because they didn't believe that they'd seen sufficient evidence, even though the interpreters and myself, my colleague David Williams, supplied photographs of them being shot, you know, bullet holes, cars being shot up, the letters from suspected Taliban members which had been pinned to their doors, these so-called night letters. So they said that, you know, there wasn't evidence to allow them to the UK, and as I said, the first scheme just excluded lots of people. For example, those that had served for 9 months in Helmand province, or those that had served for 10 years but were only in Kabul. And then later on, as a result of our campaigning, really, the policy did change several times, and it kept on being made broader. So, you know, then they allowed people in who had served prior to 2012. But again, we then got to 2021. Ben Wallace did change the policy twice. He brought in ARAP, the Afghan Relocations and Assistance Policy, and that in theory enabled people to come if they weren't interpreters, if they had other jobs, but could prove that their lives were at risk. So it changed lots and lots of times, and you know it all happened very quickly and too late in the end, because a lot of these people who were trying to get on flights at the airport in August 2021 should have been allowed in a lot sooner, you know, before the Taliban had managed to take over the country.
Yeah. And going back a little, because you mentioned that thing about intimidation and that, you know, the MOD in those early stages effectively denying that intimidation was happening, whereas anybody who'd spent any time in Afghanistan knew that any Afghan citizen who had some, you know, public affiliation with coalition forces was subject to constant threats. So did you end up thinking that you know, the British state was deliberately ignoring the reality simply because they didn't want people to come in? Or was there something a bit more complicated going on about just an inability to understand the realities of what was happening in Afghanistan?
I think I do think it was probably a slight mixture of both. I think it was more that, you know, you've got people that might not have ever even been to Afghanistan, and as you say, didn't understand what was going on the ground. having to get wade through these cases and decide whether they these people were worthy of sanctuary or not. I think also that perhaps, you know, ministers could have quite easily said to those civil servants looking at these cases, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. If they've got photographs that seem realistic, and if they definitely were interpreters, then, you know, let's let them in. Instead, it was like they're trying to sort of disprove every case. It was just a really strange way of going about it. And again, I think because they didn't really have proper files and proper, you know, proper sort of information on the on these people, that on these interpreters, then they didn't, they weren't sort of able to take a sort of bigger look at the case and then say, oh, they should be allowed, you know, they should be allowed in, looking at circumstances. Instead, they just had, you know, might have had like three words or something, dismissed for, you know, drugs or something, and there'd be no more detail about the case, and then you can't appeal those that situation. So it just seemed very, very unfair.
You mentioned just earlier about how by the time this situation was really sort of taken seriously, it was too late for many. And of course, we'll all remember those chaotic scenes at the airport in Kabul, and, you know, terrible images of crowds, people clinging onto the undersides of planes and so on. We are in a new reality that the Taliban controls Afghanistan. They absolutely clearly have plans to find and punish, in many cases, kill people who had a connection with the coalition. So what happened afterwards? Because in a way, the public attention turns away. And of course, the sequence here is it was only a few months later that Russia invaded Ukraine, and a lot of attention turned to a sort of new conflict. What happened? What's the scale of that story? How many of these people are still there trying to escape what is a very brutal regime?
So after the, at the airport, I was in touch with, you know, a lot of former interpreters and other locally employed staff who were stuck there. They'd been trying to get on the flights for days, and they hadn't managed to get into the airport because of Taliban checkpoints and because the crowds were too big. And that included Shyster and his family. They had been there ever since they'd been told they were eligible for a flight, and they'd seen horrific things. They were actually outside the airport when that terrible suicide bomb went off, which killed, you know, more than 100 Afghans and US Marines, and then they ended up having to get themselves to Pakistan. And the route there was incredibly dangerous because they were having to go through Taliban checkpoints. And Shyster was telling me how they got this medicine, and they were trying to claim that he was sick and they needed to get to Pakistan for medical help. And they were terrified. His sons were terrified that they could be pulled over at any time. They'd seen him at one point in their journey. They'd been on a bus, and they'd seen Afghans being taken off the bus and then not being allowed back on. So there was obviously a lot of speculation about what happened to them. And then they made it to Pakistan, where they ended up in these hotels that the British government were paying for. And they were actually some of the lucky ones, because they ended up on a flight to the UK quite soon afterwards. But I've been speaking to people for several, for the last couple of years, who got stuck in those hotels in Pakistan, and they're still there. They're still waiting to come to Britain, because there hasn't been housing available for them, and ministers made a decision to not allow more people to fly here until the housing was available. And they've been living there without any education. The kids can't go to school. They haven't got visas. And the situation is quite dire at the moment. I mean, we can talk about this later, because Pakistani government has now told all foreign nationals that they have to leave if they haven't got a visa.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So anyway, we're in a situation now today where there are still Afghans left in Afghanistan that have been told they're eligible to come to the UK, but they haven't yet got out of the country. And in August, that was when the latest figures came out, there were 400 Afghans still eligible stuck in Afghanistan. And there were 2,000 people stuck in hotels in Pakistan. Now, since then, they have had a flight that's come from Pakistan to the UK full of interpreters and other individuals eligible for ARAP. But there are still hundreds of people left in Pakistan at the moment.
Yeah. And it's important to reiterate that these are people who are eligible because they worked directly for the British government and, you know, served us in dangerous places, rather than people who are in generally, you know, at risk from the Taliban, who may have an asylum claim. And that second scheme, the ACRS,
yeah,
to my knowledge, was announced with great fanfare, I remember at the time, by government ministers, but there was literally no method for anyone to actually apply. It was sort of almost a fake scheme.
Oh, and this has been ridiculous. The ACRS scheme, so the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, is designed for vulnerable Afghans who, yes, didn't work directly with the British. But the only way you can apply for that is basically through a specific organisation. So, like, you have to go through the UNHCR, or other organisations. And so the Afghans that have been contacting me, such as women, for example, because a lot of the women that are, you know, women are obviously in, a lot of them are in huge danger at the moment, and they've got really, really big restrictions on their freedoms. They can't apply for ARAP because they most likely didn't work with the British forces. And their hope was applying through the ACRS scheme, but they can't apply, you know, themselves. And I'm in touch with one woman in particular, who was a former beauty salon owner. And on the day that Kabul fell to the Taliban, she just had to run home, and she got out of her jeans, donned a burqa, and she's been basically stuck at home ever since, and her mental health is really suffering. I know just recently she was hospitalized because of her depression, and she's just in an absolute desperate situation, and she sends me sort of messages appealing for help, but those messages, you know, they're not listened to, because there isn't really a way for her to get here, and it's just desperately sad.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Pakistan there, and I think we should talk a bit more about it. And just to sort of illustrate some of the challenges faced by those who've been accepted onto, the ARAP scheme. So people who we know served Britain in an earlier period. I was very recently, as it happened, trying to help one family where they've been told that, you know, their application is all in order, but in order to proceed, they need to present the original birth certificates of the members of the family. Now, when you recall that, like many people, they fled Afghanistan in a sort of, you know, in the flight of their lives, literally fleeing a hostile army, the fact that they didn't collect all their documents on departure is not surprising. And yet, In my interactions with the British state over this issue, there doesn't seem to be understanding of those kinds of basic questions.
No, I think when the withdrawal was happening in August 2021, you know, a lot of these documents people didn't end up needing. They did accept people that hadn't got passports and things like that. But over time, it's got harder and harder. And of course, if somebody needs to get a birth certificate, they're going to have to go through the Taliban controlled institution to get that. And then that raises flags of, who, you know, why do you need that? Who did you work with the British? Did you work with the Americans? And it raises the risk to their life, really. So it's just, I mean, asking for stuff like that's just not within the realms of possibility at the moment for many people. And I think that has been one of the problems that has created a backlog, because a lot of people don't actually have the right documentation. And so the British have been quite slow to get them out of places like Pakistan.
What seems bizarre about that is that you do have this situation where, as I say, you know, these are people who've already been logged as having worked for us. So it's not that we don't know who they are. I mean, it would be very different if someone showed up and said, oh, you know, I claim that I worked for you, and you, and we've got no record and they don't have a birth certificate. So we know who these people are. This just seems like a sort of bizarre bureaucratic obsession with documentation.
Yeah, I completely agree. I do think that in some cases they aren't asking for birth certificates. And I do know families that have come through just by providing, you know, they've just given them the date of birth of the rest of the family members. But it obviously completely depends on who you're dealing with. But yeah, I mean, yes, I completely agree with you. It's just it's impossible to get that type of information. You ask many Afghans what their date of birth is, and they don't have they don't have a clue, because they don't celebrate birthdays in the same way that we do in the UK. And if you ask their age, they'll give you a rough, I'm in my 20s, but they won't even actually be sure of their age. It could be it could be anything, really. And I think that is also just people just don't understand the culture there. They don't realise that it's not like how we sort of celebrate things in the UK at all.
Yeah, absolutely. But could we say a bit more about Pakistan? Because obviously, in the longer history of this story, Pakistan has had lots of close relations with the Taliban, and some would say that they're perfectly happy to see the Taliban back in control. Do you think that has an impact on the plight of these people that who are there in Islamabad or other parts of the country trying to get out?
I think there were quite a few of the Afghans, especially Shaister, actually were really nervous when they got to Pakistan, because they were told that they had to have an interview with the intelligence services. And obviously they were very fearful of that. But then when they arrived, it all seemed to go fairly smoothly. They were asked lots of questions, but then because the British had said they were going to fly them out, they then, they did get out. But of course, it's sort of a strange situation for a lot of them, because they don't trust the Pakistan government. They're just reliant on what the British government has told them. They're stuck in these hotels just waiting. And they now fear that they could be completely thrown out. So I know the British government are stepping up their flights. They're trying to get most of the Afghans out of, you know, Arab eligible Afghans out of the country, I think, by Christmas. But at the moment, there's this sort of deadline, which is actually November the 1st. The government in Pakistan has said that all foreign citizens living in the country but haven't got documents must leave by tomorrow, and if they don't, then they could be arrested and imprisoned. So you've got people that have actually lived in Pakistan for decades that are now being told they have to return to Afghanistan because they haven't got they've not got visas and things, and that's having an impact on all those Afghans that actually fled since 2021, because they're also being told they've got to suddenly leave. And I was speaking to somebody yesterday who is an interpreter living in the UK, but his brother and sister were facing intimidation by the Taliban and threats because of the interpreter service with the British Army. So he was trying to get them both out, but they haven't been told they can come to the UK. They did go to Pakistan hoping that they would be able to come, but now they're just stuck there wondering whether they're going to have to go back to Afghanistan, where they feel that there is a real risk to their life. So there'll be a lot of people in situations like that where they've left Afghanistan because of the Taliban, and now they're having to return there because they've got no other choice.
I want to talk a bit about the sort of the bigger picture. Obviously, you came to this, you come to this as you're a defense editor, defense correspondent with two major newspapers. And, you know, your work was following both the British operations in Afghanistan, but of course the international presence. What were your sort of conclusions at the end of that process, in the sense that, you know, Britain invested billions. We lost, I think, over 400 servicemen. Of course, other countries invested more. And the Afghan people themselves, you know, the price they paid is colossal. And yet at the end of that story, you know, the whole thing collapsed sort of like a house of cards in August 2021. Did you have a sort of sense that it was always going to end that way when you were covering the British deployment in earlier years?
I flew to Camp Bastion in 2014. I was on the last flight out of there with the British military. And I think then I got the sense that we're pulling out all the combat troops and the job was not done. You know, people were not living in peace and safety, and we were leaving the Afghans behind, really. We knew that the Taliban were managing to take over in some places. And I think at that point it was clear that it wasn't the time to go, and that possibly we would be able to, you know, stop the Taliban taking over by having that security and assistance mission in Kabul, but it wouldn't be enough longer term. I think then when in 2021, I'd already spent years covering the plight of the interpreters and could see how their lives were getting more and more dangerous, and they were moving around constantly because the Taliban kept on taking over certain places that they had been living. And you could see that it wasn't going in the right direction. And I think just talking to Shyster, for example, is very interesting on this, because obviously he painted a picture of what he thought about the military mission there, the NATO mission. And he was glad that he got the job as the gardener. He didn't regret that at all. But I think he thought in the early days that the British and American arrival was a great thing, and that it would change their lives and make Afghanistan peaceful and make them prosperous. And at that time he was very poor. But then, because he'd been the gardener, he described it to me as like he was now the enemy of the Taliban. And the Taliban were their enemies, and they weren't enemies before. And now it just meant that their lives were in danger, and everybody that they knew felt like their lives were in danger. Western's entire mission was completely pointless, because they'd left the country in a worse state than when they'd first arrived. And to him, it had all been for nothing, basically.
If he'd never had that job, he could have led a quiet life, probably, you know, not at risk from the Taliban. If one was trying to sort of perhaps play the devil's advocate here, the challenge that it's very clear that there's a moral imperative. And I think, you know, you've explained it in this interview and in your book in much more detail, the ways in which the British government certainly failed in its moral duty to people who had risked their lives to work with us. But there is this wider picture that immigration is a very sensitive topic politically. You know, quite a lot of media organizations and newspapers don't write positive stories about immigration. There is clearly a lot of public concern and anxiety about this question.
Yeah.
So is it sort of realistic to expect a government to be more positive and helpful.
I think what the problem is it's wading through all of these cases. I mean, the government's received tens of thousands of appeals for help. It's wading through all of them and making sure that you're identifying those people who are in danger. And that's a really difficult thing to do because everybody obviously will want to show that they are in danger if they're left behind in Afghanistan. And so, of course, the government can't accept everybody. And so I completely empathize with the problem they've got there. But then there are cases that I, listen to every single day. And I just think, how have you not accepted this person? And why are you being so mean in these cases? So, for example, just a few weeks ago, I had a man who's got a three-year-old son in Afghanistan, and they refused to let his son come and join his mother and father in the UK because his dad didn't have wasn't earning enough as a taxi driver. And we wrote about the case in the Times, and I wrote about his case in my book, and they then overturned the decision. But we shouldn't have to do that. They should have allowed this poor little kid who's forgotten who his mum and dad are to come straight away. And so, yes, there are people, many people would look at the news and people coming on the boats and think that people might think we've not got enough room here, but these people are in danger because of our military operation in Afghanistan. And so I really do feel that it's our moral duty to help these people.
Well, I think that's a really good point to sort of conclude the discussion. I guess my final question would be whether you think if there were to be another situation where British troops are involved, perhaps for a prolonged period, perhaps relying on local helpers and interpreters and so on, do you think we've learned lessons? Do you think things will be better in a future scenario, or will it always need people such as yourself to kind of force these issues onto the public agenda?
I doubt that we've learned anything. I think the only thing they've learned is that in future operations, they'll employ interpreters via third parties, via contractors, so they don't feel that they should then help them afterwards. And I know that's a very cynical view, but I just think that's the way it's going. And the people that the British government employed in the last few years in Afghanistan when they were doing this security and assistance mission weren't employed directly by the British Ministry of Defence. They were employed by third parties, and I think that says it all.
Yeah, I mean, you have to assume the Taliban don't care at all whether your contract is with a third party.
No, not obviously not.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Larissa, very much for talking to me. Just tell our listeners about your book and where they can find it.
Yes, so the book is called The Gardener of Lashkargah, and it's available in all good bookshops.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. If you want to make sure you don't miss any future episodes, why not subscribe? It won't cost you anything. And spread the word if you find these podcasts useful. Behind the Lines was produced by me, Arthur Snell, and the music is by Matty Benbrook.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.